research and precision. After the Islamic Revolution, the spirit of inquiry, inspection, investigation, and fact-checking have increased several-fold among our youth. And this is a very good thing. It shows that young people are not only enthusiastic, passionate, and energetic in different areas, but they're also rational and logical. Commenting on the importance of having strong, vibrant elections, the leader said, "I would say that strong, vibrant elections are one of the pillars of the proper administration and progress of our country. This is one of the most important means for removing obstacles to progress." Commenting further, the leader said, "This ballot box and these elections haven't been easily attained in our country. We went through a period of absolute dictatorship, and then there were sham elections before the Islamic Revolution. The elections were only in appearance, and there was no truth in them. That is, they would prepare the list in the Shah's court, and sometimes even in foreign embassies. They would give those lists, and they say that these people must become the representatives of the people. Before the revolution, we knew exactly what the electoral process and voting were like. But after the Islamic Revolution, they themselves admitted and wrote about those things in their books. People being able to go to the polls to vote with motivation, with knowledge and with faith, with expectations and with hope, hasn't been easily gained. There was much struggle to gain this in our country. Of course, this struggle started after the constitutional movement in Iran, yet the main struggle took place in the movement of our founder, the magnanimous Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, when the people stood behind the Imam and pursued this path. From the start of the struggle in 1962 until the victory of the Islamic Revolution in February of 1979, significant efforts were made in this country over the span of those 16 years. A vast amount of work was accomplished, with individuals enduring imprisonment and torture and dedicating themselves to this path. The popular movement of the people began in 1978, with Imam Khomeini leading and guiding the people to victory step by step. He taught people where they should take action, and what they needed to do, and what they should demand. He was a leader in the true sense of the word. The work of the leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, and anyone who claims this to be leader, comes from the heart and from thought and logic. It affects the hearts and minds of the people, and the Imam made an impact on people's hearts and minds. The people rose up until the Islamic Revolution was victorious. Turning to other revolutions in the world, such as the French and the Russian Revolution, where often a dictatorship follows, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "Let's look at France, for example. At the end of the 18th century, the great French Revolution took place. The people there had a revolution. They took to the streets and fought. But after the revolution, a small group of people assumed power. They remained in power for 3 to 4 years before being overthrown by another group who took their place. This cycle continued for about 10 to 12 years, and then Napoleon emerged. Napoleon established a dictatorship, independent Napoleonic government. There was no talk of elections in France at that time. Worse than that was the Russian or Soviet Revolution. Now these are the two important revolutions in our recent history." Commenting further, Ayatollah Khamenei said, In Iran, the Islamic Revolution took place on 11th of February 1979, and approximately just 50 days later, on 1st of April 1979, Imam Khomeini announced a general referendum so the people could determine the type of system of government that they wanted. And they did determine this, so he immediately brought the people to the ballot box. This is what it means to have trust in the people. This highlights the importance of having a ballot box and elections. So it did not take long for this to happen. About a year had passed after this when the elections for the Assembly of Experts for the Constitution were held. Then they voted on how the law had been passed in the Majlis, the parliament, which was the next election. This was followed by presidential elections and the parliamentary Majlis elections. So several elections were held over the course of a year. These are among the great blessings of the Islamic Revolution. Commenting further, the leader said, "Why do we insist on people participating in the elections? We believe that elections must be vibrant and they must draw a huge turnout. But why? Because the presence of the people on the scene and the ballot box is a sign of the nation's presence in this important field. This is a great asset for the country. If we can show the world that the nation is present, is important. They've seen that when this nation is present on the scene, events like the Sacred Defense and the imposed war on Iran, the nation overcomes adversaries like Saddam, who had the support of the United States, the former Soviet Union, NATO, Arab reactionary states, and everyone. And our nation drove him out of his own country and crushed and disgraced him. They've seen this happen. The enemies of the people of Iran have witnessed the miracle of the presence of the Iranian nation on the scene, so they watch to see if people are still actively involved. When the people are present at the ballot box, they realize that the Iranian nation continues to maintain its presence on the scene." In further remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "Strong elections have other positive outcomes as well. One such benefit is that with strong elections, we will have strong elected officials. For example, if there is strong participation in the parliamentary Majlis elections, the upcoming Majlis or parliament will be strong. A strong Majlis can accomplish great things and take big steps for advancing the country. Similarly, vibrant, strong presidential elections with a high turnout will mean an effective government. Therefore, strong elections will result in advancement for the country." Turning to the issue of Palestine and the situation in Gaza, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "The issue of Gaza is a fundamental issue in the Islamic world. The issue of Gaza, the tragedy in Gaza, has introduced Islam to the world. It has become clear that Islamic faith is the factor that creates such strength and resistance, as demonstrated by the Palestinian people and how they have stood against the aggressor. They have refused to give in or to raise their hands in surrender before the enemy. Despite all the atrocities that the Zionist regime has committed, the issue of Gaza has not only introduced Islam and Islamic faith to the world, it has also shed light on Western culture and Western civilization. Western culture and civilization is something that makes the policies resulted from this culture see these crimes, but be unwilling to admit that this is a genocide that is happening in Gaza. The inhumane policies of the United States have reached such a level of disgrace that the world sees the United States actively aiding and abetting the Zionists in their crime of genocide in Gaza. In final comments, the leader said, "We hope that Almighty God will grant complete victory to Islam, Muslims and Palestine, and especially to the people of Gaza." The leader wished God's greetings, mercy and blessings upon all present.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady. You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Muslim Ladies. Like always, we're here to talk about women's issue. And once more, I have the honor to be your host. Well, this is Asma, and here with me, I have Sister Rehane. Actually, she's going to introduce herself pretty much perfectly for you. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome to Muslim Ladies.
Thank you very much, Sister Asma. I'm Rehane Paisapal, and I'm happy to be here with our dear listeners. I hope you have a wonderful day today.
Of course we would have. Since it's all ladies, then it's going to be wonderful. Just for the record, she is an Islamic researcher and she works on ladies' issues and whatever that matters to us as ladies generally. So obviously, right now, if we compare women to even 50 years ago, we see a huge difference. Like 50 years ago, women were engaged in different sort of stuff and their concerns were different from the women of today, the women that we are living with them. Like among my friends, I see a lot of girls who are young and at the same time that they are studying, they're having a social role. They are being mothers and they are running an entire household, which is a very difficult task. In past, it was not much of these concerns. Like women were mostly engaged in the household stuff, like doing motherly stuff, being a perfect wife and just that. Of course, I am not saying that that was not an important task to be done. I'm just saying that they did not look at their situation the way they're looking right in today. So even you yourself might have seen among your friends that nowadays women are doing different sort of jobs at the same time, yet they're mothers, they're wives, and they are actually fulfilling different tasks.
Yes, in today's society, I believe there is a great pressure on women to have it all and do it all. And I think that is a disservice to women, because when they are expected to study, they're expected to continue their studies, as well as getting married, as well as having children, as well as having a career, and all of that altogether, it's just too much to handle for a woman.
Exactly.
And whether they like it or not, they have to focus their energy on one thing more than the other. So their attention will be divided among all of these things, and they might feel like they're spread thin on all of these different tasks. So I think that is a great disservice that we've done to women, making them feel pressured to do all of these things, since only being a mother takes all of your time.
So, and I always wonder, like, I'm a person who cannot do multitasks at the same time. whenever I see friends at university who are married and who have children, which actually right now the number of those people has totally decreased. Like, you do not see people who are married having children at the same time studying. They are focusing on one part because that's very difficult to do multitasking. Like, as for me personally, when I see women doing all these stuff at the same time, I, instead of them, am feeling like, oh my God, that's too much to handle. How they do that?
Those who have children and continue studying, they obviously can't do it by themselves. They can't, like, what are they going to do with their baby? So what they have to do and what they usually do is
call their mothers.
Yes. I mean, that is the ideal solution. Some of them put them in daycare at a young age. My sister's university professor, who is a woman, told her something which baffled me.
Which was?
She said that she put her daughter in daycare when she was 3 months old.
Oh, my goodness.
I was shocked to my core. When my daughter was 3 months old, I could not bear to leave her behind and go to a doctor's appointment for an hour or two.
Because, you know, mothers, and then they have a baby so recently, so it's an attachment.
Exactly. It's difficult for a mother to emotionally to leave her child at daycare at 3 months old to be separated from her baby.
Yeah.
And she said, for her other baby, she left her at daycare when she was 6 months old. How could she do this?
Now, a question. Just I would ask you after the break. Let's go for a short break, and then I would have a question from you. This question that I wanted to ask you in the previous part of today's episode, and by the way, you're listening to My Son Lady, and Sister Rehane and I were talking about the condition of women in today's world, like the difficulties that women are suffering from, and at the same time, the question that I had was the fact that you mentioned that professor who actually entrusted her child with the different places that they put their children to be taken care of. Now, do you call this ambition of women? Is that being selfish? Is that being ambitious? What sort of a thing is it? Because, you know, compared to that emotion that you have to your child, to a newborn baby, there's nothing that could justify living that child.
I think the main reason for that is that this woman, before having her baby, set her priorities in a way where the baby would have been an obstacle. So it was easier for her to regard that baby as an obstacle and just say, okay, in order to continue with my goals that I had since, I don't know, like years ago, I have to put this baby in another person's care so that I can fulfill this goal that I've been working towards, like half of my life, maybe.
Yeah.
Like for 5 years, maybe, 10 years, maybe. I think the issue is that women have selected goals that are not aligned with family values. So before they even think of starting a family, they set the goal that I want to get my doctorate in this major. So that goal takes, I don't know, like
Eight years.
A long time. So what do you plan on doing throughout these 8 years? Do you plan on not having children at all? Do you plan on having children and entrusting daycare, like strangers, with your baby, newborn baby?
Newborn, especially newborn.
Exactly. It's very jarring. And so I think that the problem, the issue is women selecting their goals without thinking about their family.
Or
the family
let
that
me
they
just
haven't had.
Rephrase it. Maybe they have prioritized their goals, and then in those priorities, you do not see the task of being a mother.
Yes.
And then suddenly they come up with that concept. So the thing they're going to do, obviously, is to find some other solutions for the baby that right now works as an obstacle.
Yeah, so they have their own goals that are majoring in something, majoring in university.
Or let me just put it this way. See, I'm a girl as well, and I do love to finish my studies. And it's not just about finishing. I always like to stay as this student who would always learn new stuff. So this is me. And then suddenly I decide to have a family. I decide to have a child. Now, I should pick. You know, I usually say to myself, now this is my sort of thinking. I say that you have to pick one of them. It's just doing all of them at the same time is very difficult. Now that I'm bolding that, I'm focusing on that point that I personally cannot do different things at the same time. Maybe some other women can, though we talked about the issues that are going to come as well. But just as for me, I usually say that if you come to the point that you decide to create a family, you're responsible toward that family. Then you have to put many things aside for your family, for your children, because these are human beings. I mean, it's not just like you're creating a new person. You're bringing them into this world. And then you let them grow as if it's a plant. You put it in a corner of your house and then sometimes you water it. It's not like that. It's a child. It's a human being. It's a personality. It is a member of society. You cannot just live it in trust of anyone.
Exactly. And the babies have extreme emotional needs towards their mother. The mother is all they've known from the moment they were created.
Yeah.
The mother is all they've known. And suddenly they are left in a world where there's no trace of their mother to be found. And it's frightening to a baby. Like, if you put yourself in that situation, like, it makes me emotional to think about just a helpless 3-month-old baby who knows nothing of the world but the mother's arms.
Exactly.
And is just left alone for hours and hours. You cannot just have your goals for yourself and then think of your baby as an afterthought. No, like, you have to think about it for yourself and see which one you prioritize. If your priority is your studies, then wait after it's finished.
Exactly.
And you can have the time for your child.
Exactly.
Then have your baby, then have your family, unless you actually want to prioritize your family. So in that case, everything changes. Then you have a responsibility towards that child. You cannot just leave it for strangers.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Psychologically speaking, just as you mentioned the fact that it's a baby and then it's all that he or she knows is the mother, and then that mother is taken away from them, so that's going to have a lot of impact on them. And these children are going to be part of society. And as active members of society, they're not going to be mentally prepared to share any active role.
Unfortunately, this is something that is not talked about enough. Society has projected the falseness that women can have it all and their children will be fine.
Yeah.
I remember I went somewhere at a party and a woman was asking me about my studies. I told her that I discontinued my studies because of my baby.
You quit it for the baby.
Yes. And she started saying in a condescending way, in my days, back in my day, we did it all. We had our guests. We took care of our household. We did our studies.
But
and we had our
you.
Children. And
good for
I want to ask her, like, where is your daughter now? Like, what kind of a person has she become? How close of a relationship do you have with each other? And, like, how could you know the impact that your absence had on that child?
Exactly.
You can never fully understand the extent of it.
And by the way, there is something that people usually take for granted. The task of being a mother is a great art. It's not like everybody could be a good mother. Like we can see it in our circles as well. Not all the mothers are the same. Some mothers are so selfless and some other mothers are just wishing to have it all. It's all about priorities. Like for me, and as we share the same idea, I guess, if your priority is to bring up a child, then you're responsible toward that child. I would quit everything for that child until at least an appropriate age, until an age that I'm fully sure that, okay, they are well to be left alone for some hours. Other than that, I guess that's going to be a crime you do to a child, to leave them to other people's trust at an age that they do not know anything but you. They have no center of desire aside from you. And I say it again, psychologically speaking, there are a lot of effects coming after these stuff. Like when a child does not get enough attention or care or love from their parents from an early age, that would have a huge and detrimental effect on their personality for when they are going to share a role in society. So thank you, sister. This was all the time. I quite enjoyed it myself. I hope this is the same for all the Muslim ladies out there. So until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Food for thought. Hello everyone. How about listening to a wise statement on fasting from Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The easiest duty enjoined by Allah on a fasting person is to forgo food and drink.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
More than 30,000 Palestinians have so far been killed in Israel's full-blown campaign of genocide against Gaza since October 7th last year. The war, like any other Israeli action, has received full support from the United States. But the amount of U.S. support for this particular war has been consequential, and the death and destruction caused by it have been horrendous. The U.S. support for Israel's bloodshed has been so unconditional that it has prompted the closest allies of Washington and Tel Aviv to speak up and urge an end to the American administration's blind backing for the Israeli regime. In this episode of the program, we'll take a look at how the United States is liable for genocide in Gaza as much as the Israeli regime is, in a nutshell.
The United States has been using its veto power at the United Nations Security Council to protect the Israeli regime. As a result, Israel's killing machine has been able to keep going unfazed despite the atrocious conducts of war, which has resulted in the incredibly high civilian death toll. The U.S. first vetoed a draft Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in October last year, days into the war.
The Brazilian-drafted text was killed on October 18th, and along with it, hopes that the mass murdering of the Palestinians would stop. U.S. Ambassador to the UN Linda Thomas-Greenfield said that the veto was because the draft did not mention what she called Israel's right to self-defense. Already, over 3,000 Palestinians had been killed.
Then, on December 8th last year, Washington rejected another Security Council resolution aiming to mandate a ceasefire in Gaza. Deputy U.S. Ambassador to the UN Robert Wood said that text was rushed and ignored U.S. demands. The Palestinian death toll at the time was 17,400. The third U.S. rejection of a ceasefire came on February 20th, when Thomas Greenfield bizarrely claimed any ceasefire would jeopardize U.S. negotiations with the warring sides. The Palestinian death toll kept mounting, and the humanitarian crisis in Gaza grew worse.
The U.S. stonewalling at the Security Council came even as votes at the United Nations General Assembly overwhelmingly called for a ceasefire. While resolutions agreed at the General Assembly are non-binding, they carry political weight and reflect the international community's real stance on the Israeli war. But the United States' callous posture and utmost disregard for civilian loss of life has not been limited to vetoes at the Security Council.
U.S. officials have been making numerous trips to Tel Aviv to show support for the regime. U.S. President Joe Biden made a wartime visit to Israel in a dramatic show of support in October last year. And U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has made several visits to Tel Aviv since the war started. U.S. support for the war has been more than those vetoes and official visits. The United States has been replenishing the Israeli arsenal, which would have gone dry days into the war, given the intensity of the bombardments and other military operations in the densely populated Gaza. U.S.-made military hardware of all kinds has been flowing into Israel, from ammunition for small arms to missiles, land vehicles, and aircraft.
While it is true that Israeli forces are involved in Gaza, they are essentially fighting an otherwise American war. As the war continues, a case of genocide against Israel is also proceeding at the United Nations International Court of Justice, what is also referred to as the World Court. The final verdict will probably take several years, but the fact that South Africa has filed the motion at the ICJ and is effectively prosecuting Israel shows how the international community is thirsty for justice. Four months after Israel launched war on the Gaza Strip, the regime is planning a major ground offensive in Rafah. Only one thing has made it possible for the war to go on for so long, besides the Israelis' vicious appetite for blood: American support. Without U.S. support, the Israeli arsenal would have gone dry and the Israeli economy would have collapsed early into the war. In this episode of In a Nutshell, we're looking at the crucial role that the United States is playing in the war. The war started after a surprise attack by Hamas on Palestinian-occupied territories on October the 7th last year. In the aftermath of the attack, the regime of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said it would launch a war to destroy Hamas. Almost 29,000 Palestinians have been killed since then, including 12,300 children. Hundreds of thousands have been displaced to southern Gaza, where the Israeli military now plans to launch a major ground offensive.
The United States has been replenishing Israel's arsenal by providing military vehicles, spare parts, missiles, ammunition, etc. The Israeli military has complete access to U.S. spying assets, and the Americans make sure that financial aid keeps flowing to Tel Aviv. Only last week, the United States Senate approved financial aid for the Israeli war worth $14 billion.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden was quick after the October 7 attack to emphasize Israel's right to defend itself. U.S. diplomatic cover for Israel hasn't changed. If anything, it has escalated. Repeated attempts by the United Nations Security Council members to hold a vengeful Israel in check have run into a stone wall, with the United States vetoing resolution calling for a ceasefire to allow the delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza.
The United States has also repeatedly called a South Africa-initiated case against Israel at the International Court of Justice meritless. Lawyers for South Africa have been claiming that there is concrete evidence to make a plausible case that the Israeli military has been conducting genocide in the Gaza Strip. The United States' quick dismissal of the argument came even as a panel of 15 judges on the ICJ, also known as the World Court, are to decide, and as any decision is likely to take several years. Still, it is a sign of consternation on the part of the judges that they have already directed preliminary measures to be taken to make sure acts of genocide are prevented.
It is a sign of consternation about the unconditional nature of U.S. support for Israel that EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell recently suggested that the U.S. cut military aid to Tel Aviv. He pointed to Biden's recent comments that Israel's military action was over the top, and said if the U.S. president truly believed too many people were being killed in Gaza, he should provide less weapons to the regime.
Aside from America's growing isolation on the global stage due to its support for Israel's genocidal campaign, the U.S. administration has also drawn the ire of many American people as well, as social media keep bringing in unfiltered scenes from Gaza. Many protests have been held over the past months in different cities, demanding that the Biden administration stop backing the bloodshed.
The United States' role in the war is so crucial that it is not hard to imagine the Israeli soldiers effectively fighting an American war. And while the ICJ case is not considering material U.S. support for Israel in the proceedings over accusations of genocide, it is conceivable that the enablers of the war would one day be held accountable on the world stage. Until that day, though.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. By his name, we start. Salamun alaikum and salam to the month of Allah, the month of Quran.
Love is everywhere. So much peace fills up the air. Ramadan, month of the Quran. I feel it inside me, strengthening my emotions.
On Thursday, we are here from IRIB English Radio. Today's a special. Today's 3rd of Ramadan, 1445 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 24th of Isfand, 1402 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 14th of March, 2024 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. For today, we'll listen to chapter Waqa, chapter 56 of the Holy Quran, verses 77 to 79.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Innahu laqur'anun kareem.
Indeed, it is a noble Quran.
Fi kitabin maknoon.
In a register well protected.
La yamassuhu illa al-mutahharun.
None touch it except the purified.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
The attribute Karim employed for the glorious Quran refers to Allah Almighty, the most glorious and the most benevolent, and the same attribute also designates a human virtue. The Arabic world also reflects the great merits of the Holy Quran and its eloquence and rhetorical figure, as well as its interesting content. Since it is revealed by the Lord, who is the origin of perfection and beauty, Allah Almighty is the origin of revelation as well as goal of the Holy Quran. The point is that the divine omniscience is free from any error or alteration, and it is evident that such book originating from such sublime source, whose original vision is in the well-preserved tablet, is far from any error and alteration.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Dua for the 3rd day of Ramadan in this part.
Allahumma arzuqni fihi dhihna wa tanbih wa ba'idni fihi min as-safahati wa tanbih waj'al li nasiban min kulli khayrin tunzilu fi bijudika ya ajwada al ajwadi.
O Lord, grant me in it intelligence and attentiveness. Distance me in it from nonsense and concealment. Allot for me a portion of everything good which you send down in it with your generosity, O most generous one.
Shukran ya Rabbi, shukran. Hadayta qalbi, shukran.
شكراً يا ربي شكراً هديت قلبي شكراً نورت دربي شكراً شكراً يا رب يا منزل القرآن يا خالق الإنسان يا ربي يا
Ramadan is the month of Quran. One of the reasons Ramadan is for special for Muslims around the world is because it is the month in which Allah began to reveal the Quran to the Prophet Muhammad. Allah says in the Holy Quran itself, in chapter Al-Baqarah, verse 185, the month of Ramadan is the one in which the Quran was revealed as guidance for mankind, and as clear signs that show the right way and distinguish between right and wrong. Again, there was verse 185 of second chapter of the Holy Quran. The recitation of the Quran is greatly emphasized in this month, the month of Ramadan. Many Muslims try to recite it as much as possible, as well as listen to it during the night. There is something very special about the Quran. It has a uniqueness and beauty that has a great effect on and moves the heart. Many accepted Islam after hearing the words of the Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Today, we are going to talk about the holy month of Ramadan and the month of companionship with Al-Quran. How can we be a good companion with the Holy Quran? The month of Ramadan, which is the month of the revelation of Quran, has a strong connection with the Quran. To show this connection, we will briefly examine a few verses from the Holy Quran. In verse 183 of Surah Al-Baqarah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala states the ruling and obligation of fasting, and to emphasize its importance, he mentions the universality of fasting, saying, "This ruling is not specific to you Muslims, and was also obligatory upon the previous nations." At the end, he recognizes the result of fasting as divine piety and spiritual development. Then in the next verse, verse 184, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala exempts three groups from this ruling. First, the sick. Second, travelers. And third, the elderly. The first two groups must make up for the missed fast after regaining health and completing their journey. Respectively, however, the third group is only obligated to pay the fasting expiation, which is 750 grams of wheat or a similar amount. Additionally, physical inability exempts young girls who have just reached the age of religious obligation from the obligation of fasting. Considering this can solve the issue of making fasting obligatory for girls who have reached puberty, as reaching the age of puberty, not just 9 years, is one of the conditions of religious obligation, and physical ability is another condition. Therefore, fasting is not obligatory for weak and incapable adolescent girls. Following the above verse, verse 185 of Surah Al-Baqarah declares Ramadan as the month of fasting, and in describing the importance of this month, it introduces Ramadan as the month of the revelation of the Holy Quran, saying, شهر رمضان الذي أنزل فيه القرآن هدى للناس وبينات من الهدى والفرقان. The month of Ramadan is the one in which the Quran was revealed as guidance for mankind and clear proofs of guidance and the criterion.
شهر رمضان الذي
In the holy month of Ramadan, the month of Allah.
Be with IRIB English Radio, today's special.
Every day for 15 minutes.
وَمَضَاتُ خَيْرٍ لِلْعِبَادِ وَمَضَاتُ نُورٍ لِلْفُؤَادِ وَمَضَاتُ خَيْرٍ لِلْعِبَادِ وَمَضَاتُ نُورٍ لِلْفُؤَادِ
What makes the Quran so profound? So what is it about the Quran that has such a profound effect on human beings and even the rest of the creation? There are many answers to this question. For one, the Quran is the direct word of Allah. There was no person who wrote this or was inspired to write this. It was revealed to mankind directly from Allah. The Quran is also meant to be recited, not read silently. There is a rhythm to the words, a pattern, and oftentimes a rhyme that you can hear whether or not you understand the Arabic language. There are many videos of people reacting to hearing the Quran for the first time, and even though the listener does not understand the meaning of the words, they still recognize the recitation as something beautiful and moving.
أرجو رضاك يا الله أنت الرحيم يا الله هبني عطاك يا الله أنت الكريم منك العطاء يا الله أنت العظيم يا فيك الرجاء يا الله أنت الحليم
الرحمن الستار ملك الملك الغفار الوهاب المنان المتعال
الرحمن الستار ملك الملك الغفار الوهاب المنان المتعال
الله الله يا ربي يا الله
Salam to the spring of the Holy Quran, the month of Ramadan. The month of Ramadan has been aptly named the spring of the Quran. During this month, believers set aside more time than usual to understand the world of Allah, to learn to ponder over its verses. Muslim homes and mosques ring with the beautiful recitation of this glorious book. It is the season of Quran reciting when the desire to learn and understand the word of Allah blooms and flourishes, just as the natural would blossoms in the spring. The Prophet Muhammad al-Mustafa, peace be upon him, and his pure progeny said, "Everything has a springtime, and the springtime of the Quran is the month of Ramadan."
Ramadan is the month in which the Quran was revealed. That's true, brothers and sisters. It was revealed as the means of guidance for humanity, for human beings, and for guidance and distinguishing the truth from the falsehood. From this noble verse, it is understood that the most important features of the month of Ramadan is the revelation of the Holy Quran, which was revealed to the heart of the beloved Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam on the night of Qadr. Ramadan is the month of worship, self-building, abandoning sins and obeying commands. For the realization of this important matter, both teaching and training are necessary. The Quran teaches man and fasting trains him. It is only through these two that reaching perfection is possible. In reality, the Quran without the obligation of fasting is incomplete teaching without development, and Ramadan and fasting without the Quran is training without knowledge and awareness. Therefore, a Muslim must revive Ramadan by fasting and train himself, and also be guided by being close to the Holy Quran and becoming familiar with it. Because the Quran is both guidance, clear proofs, and the criterion, hudan linnas, wabayyinat min al-huda wal-furqan. Such a Quran was revealed in the month of Ramadan, and fasting was also made obligatory in this month. For this reason, special attention should be paid to these two divine gifts. Thank you very much, brothers and sisters, for staying tuned and listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode. Please keep us in your dua and supplication. Have a nice time, and we leave you in Allah's protection.
Subhanaka Rabbi, Subhanaka, Subhanaka ma a'zama shanak, nad'uka wa narju ghufranak, nad'uka wa narju
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
An injured 90 civilian in yet another attack on aid seekers in northern Gaza as the regime's genocidal war enters its 160th day. An aid boat set sail from Cyprus is gradually heading toward the Gaza Strip.